Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to Cover Story, a podcast by New Books Network about long-form journalism. My name is Aga Popenda, and today we're talking with David Schmaltz, who is a staff writer at the Monterey County Weekly, where his long-form pieces have won numerous awards from the California News Publishers Association, including first place for Enterprise Reporting in 2014, for an expose he wrote about a local church's attempt to evict residents from 98 federally subsidized apartments. Those residents were able to keep their homes, and the property remains the largest affordable housing complex on the Monterey Peninsula. Hi, David.
Hey.
He also did a lot of other reporting that we will talk about, and other than 4 years he spent working and traveling abroad that we will also talk about, David has lived and worked his entire life in California. Is that all correct?
It is.
Awesome. So can we talk about why you decided to go into to journalism in the first place, and when you started for the first time to be active in the field?
Okay. Well, I've always been drawn to writing. When I was in college, at some point, I was taking a class. I think it was the American Novel was the name of the class, and I was reading a lot of contemporary fiction, which is something that in my high school English classes I never read. I only read the classics and whatnot. And once I got exposed to contemporary fiction and realized, just what was out there and writing that really spoke to me in a way that a lot of the stuff I read in high school did not. I just realized that was something that I really appreciated and like I loved more than anything was good writing. And I had done writing in high school. I was the sports editor for my high school newspaper, and I had my own column in that paper. And so I had done writing and stuff before, but I just kind of, the way that I was raised, like everyone went out and became a lawyer or a banker or a doctor or something like that. Like no one's going into journalism. And so it sort of took me a while to get to this place, to sort of let go of all that, all the sort of expectations for what I should be doing. And it took me a while to get there. And ultimately, I started freelancing for the Weekly, around 2010 or 11. Mm-hmm.
Before we go there, can I ask you, what was this mind-blowing writing that you found so different? Can you give some names?
Yeah, I think the book that really, just changed everything for me was Don DeLillo's White Noise. Mm-hmm. It was just so different and so contemporary. I mean, it was a novel published in the 80s. I can't remember if it was 84 or maybe a couple years before that, but, it was sort of really about the sort of modern American condition. And and some of the sentences in that book, you know, just really blew me away. And then, so I started to read more Don DeLillo and discover, you know, some of his other books. And I realized there's this whole, you know, vast universe out there of really incredible contemporary fiction. And that I sort of did not know existed growing up. Mm-hmm.
So how old are you when you're making this discovery? Well, you pretty much just said when the novel was published. No, you couldn't. That's a novel published in the 80s, so you could not have read it first when it was published.
No. Yeah, so I was probably maybe 21 years old at the time when I made this discovery.
All right. So, but, you know, DeLillo is a novelist. I'm not sure if he was ever active as a journalist. Actually, I don't know much about him, about his biography, but... you decided to submit pieces to the Weekly instead of like submitting short stories to the Harper's, and I'm sure you had a reason.
Well, I did initially. I was, you know, drawn to fiction writing, and I did take a fiction writing course through UCLA Extension, and UCLA was the school that I went to undergrad in, so it was local to where I was. But, you know, then I wrote a screenplay at one point, around 2007, eight, and,
about what and what happened to it?
So nothing happened to it. But I thought it was a really, and still think it is a really cool story. And it was about, based on a true story about, a former, Cambodian child soldier, who was, I believe, 3 years old when the Khmer Rouge took power in 1975 in Cambodia. And, he just had this incredible life story, fought for like four different armies, basically just getting captured and fighting on different sides. But after all the fighting ended in the 90s, he went out and started... taking all the, you know, unexploded ordnance out of the forests. He would just go around and demine the landscape. And that sort of became what he did for like his life. And he started a museum next to Siem Reap in Angkor Wat. And
it sounds like an amazing potential long form journalism piece.
Yes. Unfortunately, it was a challenge to communicate with him because his English was not great. And so that made it hard. And he also, you know, I spent a lot of time with him. I went on demining expeditions in the Cambodian forest with him. And that was pretty wild. And went hunting overnight with him one time. And
so is that happening before you started your work for the Weekly around?
Yes. This all was happening like 2007. And I started freelancing for the Weekly. I think 2011 was the first year that I published something there. And so the reason that, you know, that whole thing panned out, cause at that point I was working for a nonprofit in San Francisco, and, one of my best friends, was the managing editor at the Weekly, and he knew I was a writer, and he knew I could write because he's read my stuff before, and so he encouraged me to start freelancing for the Weekly, and so that's sort of how that started.
Did you have an original beat that was assigned to you? Now I know that you cover Seaside.
Well, when I was freelancing, I had no, you know, that was not covering anything specifically. And I was just sort of pitching ideas that I thought would be fun stories that I could write. I wasn't like a hard news reporter per se at the time, even though I did write on some, you know, very meaty topics in some cases. And I did end up being a part of an award-winning story about a pesticide as a freelancer. I did some hard news reporting then. Mm-hmm. But so I was just sort of living my life in San Francisco and doing some for the Weekly every now and then while I was doing my full-time job. And then I ended up working for a startup. I got laid off, you know, after 6 months, they ran out of money. And then some came up with the weekly where they had someone who was going on maternity leave for 5 months. And so they hired me to basically fill in and be a staff writer while this person was on maternity leave. And then after...
Do you remember your first cover story in the weekly?
Well, I wrote two cover stories as a freelancer, neither of which I'm very proud of now. But the first one that I did when I was sort of on staff was I co-wrote a story about a fire that broke out like a month after I got here in Big Sur. And that was it was a really good story. I was really proud of the reporting I did in that story. And then the next one was about the decline of the sardine population.
Does the crisis continue?
Yes, it does.
Okay, let's talk about this story that we will link to this episode, which is this the story you got the award for in 2014. That sounds amazing. Can you just make some sort of introduction for people who never?
I got a tip that these residents at this housing complex is called Del Monte Manor, and it was built around 1970. I reported the story years ago, so I'm going to try to not be too precise about, certain details, but it was five local, actually six at the time, churches, nonprofits, civic groups that teamed up together to build this, this housing complex. And 98 of the units were subsidized by the by HUD, by the federal government. Mm-hmm. And I got a tip that the church, who basically was one of the original sort of founding entities of this complex, and was also co-located, like the church is literally right next to it, and they kind of had taken over the management of the board of directors for this housing complex. And it had a very tumultuous history, in the aughts, and they brought in someone to manage the complex who was totally unqualified and incompetent. And so what happened was they weren't able to properly fill out the paperwork to send to the federal government to get the subsidy money. Mm-hmm. So what happened is they just started going into massive debt because they weren't getting the federal money that they were supposed to be getting because the management couldn't fill out the paperwork. And so instead of solving that problem, what the leaders of the board, it was basically the leader of this church, decided they were going to do was, we're just going to kick all these people out onto the street and then change the rents to market rate because we don't want to deal with the paperwork. Mm-hmm. And, once the sort of contours of the story became clear to me, I knew it was,
So what was the source of the problem? Was it like one person's bad will, some sort of...
I would say two people's bad will. Mm-hmm. And it all stemmed because they were incompetent. That was the mm-hmm. that was the thing that was so maddening about it was, they were incompetent. They couldn't get the money from the feds because they didn't know how to do the paperwork. So instead of, making it right, they decided they're just going to kick all these people out on the street. And I thought that was, an outrage. Mm-hmm. And
So who are your sources, and also how this particular church reacted when you started to snoop around?
Well, so my sources were mostly residents at the complex. Also, though, you know, I filed a FOIA request to get all the documents that HUD and, you know, Del Monte Manor had been sending, you know, back and forth. And I got some really good material from that FOIA request. And that was a huge piece of my report.
May I ask you this? Since the biggest dilemma with FOIA requests is that often governments, local governments, agencies try to delay it. So what was your experience with
well, this? This is actually the only FOIA request that it was like through like the federal government that I've ever done.
It seems that it worked for you.
It worked, and I think part of the reason why it worked so well was because the people that my contacts at HUD were very sympathetic to, you know, the cause of the residents at this complex, and also to what I was trying to do as a reporter and exposing it. They were at an impasse with, you know, the management of this complex, and so they had every incentive to give me all the material, you know, and so that helped me as well. Like, I wasn't necessarily exposing them for something they were doing. It was the opposite. And so I think that helped. And I had some good people who were, after they read the first story, like I did a news story, then that became a long form piece several months later. But once I wrote the initial story, all kinds of people came to me and became sources. And one of the best sources that I had was, you know, this woman who was she was the head of like the residents association. And she was, you know, a woman who has won all these awards, you know, from everyone in the community. Like, she's, you know, gotten an award from the local congressman and the board of supervisors and the city of Seaside for all the work she's done in the Seaside community over the course of her life. And so for her to become like a good source for me, I mean, that was critical, because it was like, this is not just some, you know, angry residents. This woman really had a lot of credibility. And so, but yeah. And so I'd go to the meetings, and just take notes. And the church's reaction was, they did not like me. But they also didn't respond to my calls. They would not comment on the story. Mm-hmm. They never did the whole time. So that was but in the end, after, you know, all the information got out there, the community stepped up, and they made sure that did not happen, that those people got to stay there.
And so how quickly after the publishing of this story, these things got resolved? Was it something that kept simmering for a while, or?
It was surprisingly quick. How quickly it was resolved. I believe my story, the cover story, I believe ran in, it was either late June or early July of 2014. And by sometime in August, so like a month or two later, the Seaside police escorted the property manager off the property, and she was forced to leave, and they changed the locks. So it was pretty quick.
Okay, so this is 2014, and you are already a staff writer in the weekly, and I assume that you moved from San Francisco area to Monterey full-time by then?
Yes.
I thought that you would be a perfect person to talk about local journalism, because you've been you know, observing it for a while. And, you know, I'm talking about this whole commentary about local journalism dying, all those outlets dying. I know that this is not the case for Monterey County Weekly. I wonder, what do you think makes local journalism here in Monterey possible?
Well, I think we have a very engaged community. A lot of the people who live here, they're educated. They want to know what's going on in their community, and there's not a big newspaper that serves this area. You know, I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and you know, you've got the Chronicle, which covers, you know, the greater Bay Area, and then you've got the Mercury News and the East Bay Times and all these different ones. But down here, there's nothing that really, you know, covers the local area that's a bigger paper. So you need the local papers. And, you know, the Monterey Herald has been bought out by one of these vulture capitalist firms and has sort of been gutted and doesn't really produce in the way that it once did. And so everyone turns to the Weekly for their news. And it's a free paper, and a lot of people pick it up and read it. And therefore, I guess, you know, we're able to sell a lot of ads. And so, yeah, it seems to be thriving. It's only gotten bigger since I've been at the Weekly.
It's amazing. And what do you think makes for a good cover story for the Weekly, since Weekly is being published on a weekly basis? And, you know, and there's always a great cover story, and I'm sure you've read millions of them.
Well, I mean, for me, as a news writer, you know, I always want to, I want to have a really juicy piece of news if I'm going to do a cover story. And if I don't have that, going in, I probably think it's not going to be one of my best, you know. But if it's something really juicy and important, like, that to me is sort of the necessary ingredient for it to be a truly great story.
Okay.
Because I can write, you know, it's not about how well you write it if no one really cares about what you're trying to show them or tell them.
So do you remember most explosive cover stories in the Weekly that, like, when the paper hit the streets, you guys started to have, like, tons of phone calls and everybody talked about it? Yeah, something like
yes,
that.
Yes, yes. There's definitely one story like that that stands out. A story that our colleague Mary Duane wrote, I think that was also in 2014, about corruption at the King City Police Department. And she had really good sourcing, and she basically found out about all these cops getting arrested, you know, by federal authorities early one morning. And she had it all. And it came out in the Weekly. And it was like she broke this massive story in a cover story, which is so hard to do. And so, you know, every other local news outlet out here was chasing, you know, her reporting for a week after that. And it was, that was something.
Incredible. Okay. I want to ask you about your experience as a consumer of long form journalism. But before we go there, I also want to mention a couple of other stories of yours that were particularly successful. This last remaining coastal sand mine in America. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah. So there's this. There's this sand mine that no longer is in operation now, in part because of my reporting, I would like to think. But anyways, it had been here for decades on the coast. Monterey, along the southern coast of Monterey Bay, used to be a very have a lot of sand mining. Back in up until the 1980s, I think there was like five sand mines shut down in the 1980s along the coast of Monterey Bay. And sand mining, the reason it's a problem is because it creates coastal erosion. Basically, you're just mining the coastline, essentially. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, especially problematic in a time of, you know, rising seas. And so when I saw the sand mine still existed and these local activists were trying to, you know, sort of raise awareness about it, I just realized that, wow, this is incredible. I cannot believe this exists. It's something that you drove by all the time without even really knowing what it was and thinking about it too much when you're driving along Highway 1. And so I decided, went to my editor and said, I'm going to write a cover story about this. And I immediately knew it was going to be great because I knew that this sand mine should not exist anymore. It just makes no sense. I knew I was going to be able to get what I needed to really write just a barn burner of a story. And that story really sent shockwaves through the community.
That sounds incredible. What year was it?
I think it was, it's hard if it is 2016 or 2015. It was right around, it was either like January 1st of 2016 or late. Yeah. I think it was like the first cover story of that year, I think is when it came out.
Yeah. And since another story of yours is about, you helped to stop this development, the largest proposed development in Monterey County history that would have removed tens of thousands of coastline oaks. I can see a pattern here. There is definitely some sort of environmentalism involved.
Yes, definitely. I mean, and that was, that was one of my beats at the time was the environment, but it's certainly something that I'm deeply passionate about. And I try to work into all of my stories, and to some degree, so that story was, it was one of the reasons that my editors assigned me to cover the city of Seaside is this development was in the pipeline and they knew that I was the type of reporter who could maybe stop it. I don't know how else to put it, basically the project was approved and it was gonna happen. And then, it was on its way to approval. Let's put it that way. It had sort of received all these approvals, but it wasn't yet the final environmental impact report had not yet been approved when I wrote the story. But I was just sort of racking my brain for, you know, what can I do to move the needle on public opinion about this project, which, I mean, probably would never have been built anyway. It would have gotten litigated to death. But so I got a tip about the developer and some of his, you know, legal problems with his own family. And so I did some investigation and found, that he had, there's definitely some meat on the bone for some court documents down in Los Angeles. And the problem was, though, is you can't get those documents online. You needed a courier. We had to hire a courier to go pull these court files and copy and then send them to us. And so we did that. I pitched that to my editor, said, look, let's spend, $300 and get like this first, sort of set of documents to see if there's something here. And so my editor agreed. And so we got the documents. And then once I opened them up, I was like, oh boy, we got something. And then so at that point, I started going through the attorneys for this developer's sister, who then sort of provided me almost all the other documents. And then, basically what I ended up doing was just writing this huge expose about this guy, who does not seem like someone who, you know, a city would want to, put their hopes and dreams behind this guy getting this thing done, because mm-hmm. his history would demonstrate that he would fail miserably and probably, you know, owe the city money. And so, it changed the way the public saw him and the project, to a measurable degree. And then, like a month or two later, like the city council overturned all of its approvals of the project and it died an unceremonious death.
So pretty much your goal is to get a nice statue in the city of Seaside. Yes?
No, I don't honestly. Yeah. I don't want it to be about me. I'm motivated by, you know, social justice, environmental justice, and, you know, those are the things that really get me going. I love writing, you know, and I love writing well, but the stories that I really get most passionate about and probably work the hardest on are the ones where I feel like it matters. Mm-hmm. The story matters.
So would you say that that nonfiction for you is more for fulfilling than, let's say, fiction?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, and I've never... You know, I think the reason that I'm drawn to nonfiction is because I don't feel like, from a fiction standpoint, I don't feel like I have stories to tell that are mine. Like I don't feel like I'm that interesting. I don't want to try to convince anyone that I, you know, they should care about my stories. You know, mm-hmm. I just try to find stories out there that I think people would like, and so. I mean, for me, that's what it is. I don't have stories pouring out of me that are fictional. And so I got to go out and get the true ones.
Okay, fair. We should also probably say that since David became a staff writer in Monterey County Weekly, he worked for 5.5 years, then took a break, and now he's back in the Weekly, where we met as colleagues a couple of weeks ago. David, I also want to ask you about you as a reader of long-form journalism, which I'm sure is your whole life. Can we go, did you have like some sort of phases when you, like, as a teenager, read New Yorker religiously or whatever? What magazines were important for you? What writers were important for you? What books were important for you? And who are your writing heroes, except of Delillo?
Okay. I would say that I, you know, when I was growing up, like, I would read, my dad subscribed to Sports Illustrated, and Sports Illustrated used to have really good writing. I used to read that growing up. And when I got to college, you know, I was just studying and doing all this and that. It was after I graduated college that I really got into reading journalism regularly. I would read the A section of the LA Times every day. I subscribed to it, and because I wanted to, like, learn. I was so thirsty for information about the world, you know. I was like 22, and I was like, the world's so huge, I've hardly seen any of it. Like, I want to know. And so I'm reading everything I can, you know. It was a really big newspaper back then too. But in terms of, like, magazine journalism, like, I'd say the first magazine that I really started getting into was Harper's. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of stuff I read in Harper's that I really liked. But ultimately, I just kind of got off Harper's because I just found it too depressing, honestly. It just felt like it was, you know, kind of making me more angry and sad about the state of the world. This was like post 9/11 America, you know. Mm-hmm. And so eventually I started I canceled my Harper subscription, as cheap as it was, and then started subscribing to The New Yorker, and I've been subscribed to The New Yorker for, you know, over a decade. And that's where, you know, I feel like, you know, that's reading that has helped me a lot as a long form writer.
Do you have your favorite New Yorker writer?
My favorite New Yorker writer, well, God, there's so many I love, but the guy who's, I think, is just a long form savant. I mean, he's just incredible. His name is David Gran, Gran with two N's. But he, for whatever reason, he hardly ever publishes any stories. Whenever he does, they're incredible. But he wrote a really incredible book. You know, I think now it's being adapted into a movie, but it came out, I don't know, 4 years ago, called Killers of the Flower Moon, which I highly recommend to your listeners. I mean, that book is incredible, and what an incredible piece of journalism it is. And it's one of those stories, and I don't want to sort of spoil it or anything, but it's one of those stories where you read it and you wonder, how the hell did this not get reported already? You know, this is like a story that's almost 100 years old. And it's just sitting there. And this guy comes along and, like, suddenly you're like, oh my God, this is insane. And that's what David Grant does. He just finds these crazy stories, and I don't know how he does it. But he's no one better at it than him. So he's one guy I really like. But there's a lot of people for the New Yorker, right? But I like one story that also I find is still so memorable to me is, she won a Pulitzer for it, but Catherine Schultz, her story about the really big one, that was the headline for, an earthquake that's, you know, sort of coming in the Pacific Northwest. What an incredibly well-written piece that was. I actually pulled up a line from there because it's just such incredible writing. So she's describing how this forest that she's paddling through on like a canoe, how all the trees died because seawater came in after this earthquake made the ground subside. And so, like, basically this forest suddenly just dropped like below sea levels, sort of how it happened. And she writes, leafless, branchless, barkless, they are reduced to their trunks and worn to a smooth silver gray, as if they had always carried their own tombstones inside them. I mean, that's just great writing right there. And so, you know, that there's definitely pieces, you know, like always in the New Yorker that really jump out to me. But, you know, I would also encourage people who, you know, John McPhee is a great writer. And I don't know, God, the guy is immortal. He still writes for the New Yorker. He's, you know, he's written for the New Yorker since, like, I don't know, the 50s or early 60s. I mean, he's just been around forever. One of my favorite stories ever is a story he wrote back in the 70s called The Forager, about his, like, you know, 2 weeks that he spent with this guy who was like the, you know, the sort of preeminent, like, wild food forager in America. And that was a really fun read. But I encourage, yeah, John McPhee.
Amazing.
I got interrupted by a roommate. Those are the people that I love the most. I mean, I could go on and name more names.
No, I think this is more than enough. I will check out both of those writers. I'm familiar with the names, that definitely requires more exploring. And thank you so much for your time. I think that I ask all the questions that I had prepared for you, David. And thank you so much for your time.
You are welcome, and thanks for having me.
And David Schmaltz is a staff writer at the Monterey County Weekly. Thank you so much.
Thank you.